As we begin our study together tonight, I want to say thank you to the Hatton congregation. Thank you to your elders and ministers for the opportunity to come and to spend some time studying the book of Revelation with you. This is a special book to me. I truly love it. Haven't always, and I'll explain a little bit about that in just a minute, but at the outset tonight, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. You have my condolences as well, since Dexter's here with you. I know how much you struggle, but we thank you so much for sharing him with us. He is a blessing to us at Mars Hill. I truly love him. He's a great person to work with. I have learned already that if he looks at you and says something with a straight face, don't believe him. I assume he learned that when he was a politician, but I'm not really sure. But anyway, we sure do appreciate him. We really do. And anyway, thank you for the opportunity. Tonight we turn our attention to the book of Revelation. And as we do, I want to tell you that I'm not going to talk about Revelation very much tonight. And there's a reason for that, because I need to do some preliminaries to set the stage. And I hope that you will bear with me. Actually, lessons 2 through 5, I will try to cover the 22 chapters of the book of Revelation. And I've got a lot to cover tonight, so I ask you to buckle your seatbelts, because once we get started tonight, we're going to go pretty fast as we go and try to understand what's taking place in the preliminaries. When we understand the preliminaries, that'll help us a great deal as we get to the book of Revelation. Let me say at the outset, I have not always enjoyed teaching the book. When I came to Morris Hill in the 1970s, I was asked to teach the book of Revelation, and I declined. I declined because when I was in high school and studying the book of Revelation at Morris Hill, the teacher said, well, it's very hard to understand, and so we looked at about 5 or 6 different explanations. Well, 5 or 6 different explanations are difficult to grasp. So I went to college, and when I was at Lipscomb, I had the opportunity to sit with one of the scholars, and he opened the class by saying, Book of Revelation is very difficult to understand, and so we'll look at it from 3 different viewpoints. And I thought, well, that's basically what I heard when I was in high school, but after I finished, I really didn't know which one of those viewpoints made a whole lot of sense in comparison with the others. And that was frustrating. So when I came back to teach at Morris Hill, they asked me to teach it, and I said no. However, I was teaching apologetics or Christian evidences, and occasionally some of my students would ask a question about the book of Revelation. I would slough it off. I would say, well, that's difficult to understand. Wait till you get a little bit older and you'll understand. And, of course, I could tell that it did not set very well with them when I gave them that answer. And eventually, one of them had the courage to say, well, now, wait a minute. God gave us the book of Revelation. You mean to tell me he gave us something we can't understand? I got to thinking about that, and you know, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Because if God gave us this book, and we're going to look at the first verse or two in a minute, he gave us something that he wanted us to understand. It's those of us who are constantly looking elsewhere outside the Bible that have created the difficulties in the book of Revelation. Now today, occasionally you will see circulars like the one that will pop up on your screen in just a second here. I'm sure you've seen them in the newspapers. You may have gotten some in the mail in which what you're hearing is the book of Revelation is talking about all of these events that are taking place in modern time. As a matter of fact, you can even go to the bookstore and you can pick up a book which will say basically Revelation is about to happen, about to be fulfilled. Or if you turn to ads that you will see in the paper, you will see all sorts of modern day headlines, and there's Revelation. The implication is, as you read the book of Revelation, you're reading about the year 2011. You may have heard in recent days they've been talking about the concept of 2012. And I love this little cartoon that appeared in Christianity Today, because you notice they've crossed out the year 2000. World will end in 2000. They've marked that out and said 2012. Over on the side, there was another comment which said, basically, are you ready for the rapture? And it was mentioning that it was going to happen in 1992. Or you can see, again, on this next slide, some other things that appear quite often. We hear that the United States is modern-day Babylon, or if it's not the United States, it's China, or it's Russia, or it's one of the Arab nations. And again, you'll read all sorts of things that try to say the book of Revelation is talking about things that are happening in modern times. And of course, History Channel has been releasing things right now about Doomsday 2012. And all of these are saying, well, pick up the book of Revelation and you'll read about everything that's happening in our world. Now, there are problems with these interpretations. And the problems are very simple. One, they require constant reinterpretation. You see, people have been using the book of Revelation since about the second or third centuries, and every group has claimed it was talking about their time period. People in the year 300 were saying, oh, the book of Revelation is talking about the events that are taking place right now. People in the year 1000 were saying, the book of Revelation is talking about the events that are taking place right now. People in 1500 were saying, the book of Revelation is talking about events that, you get the idea. Well, what happens is, as people use the book of Revelation for that purpose, they cause people to lose their faith because when they turn out not to be talking about events that were taking place, people then look at the book of Revelation and they say, well, you can't trust it because you said it was talking about these events happening right now, and obviously it's not. So it must not come from God. And of course, if the book of Revelation doesn't come from God, then why should we believe the rest of the Bible does? You can find all sorts of examples. Let me just share a couple of you real quickly. Back in 1844, a man by the name of William Miller used the book of Revelation, the book of Daniel, and a couple of the other Old Testament prophets to predict that the world was going to end. Specifically, the world was going to end on October the 23rd, 1844. And he moved throughout the Northeast and attracted quite a following. People were called Millerites, but they believed him. And he was very sincere in his teaching. But then October 23rd, 1844 rolled around and the world didn't end. So what happened? A lot of people lost their faith. As a result of someone predicting that the Bible was going to have something to occur, and then when it didn't occur, they blamed God and they blamed the Bible and they said, well, you just can't trust that. You can find all sorts of other examples. Let me just go down to Edgar Wisnett in 1988. I'm going to use this because this affects some folks that Nancy and I knew. We had gone to Lipscomb with them, and 1988, this civil engineer in Nashville writes a book basically saying, I've read the book of Revelation, the book of Daniel, the book of Ezekiel, Zechariah, etc., and according to these books, the world is going to end in 1988 and Christ is going to return. Now, some of our friends in Nashville followed his teaching and were convinced that that was in fact going to take place. And it didn't. September 19th, 1988 rolled around and then literally rolled around. And on September the 20th, everything was going just like it was and they lost their faith. Again, that's the problem that so many people have in trying to deal with the book of Revelation. And so with that in mind, let's go to the next slide and let's talk about the methods that we're going to use as we spend some time talking about the book of Revelation. Here's the first thing. As we go through here, for the most part, I'm not going to talk about any human concept. Because what happened eventually after I was challenged is I began to sit down and just simply read the book. Well, no, I got to admit, I didn't do exactly that. When some of my students challenged me and I finally went to sit down and study the book, you know what I did? I grabbed the commentaries. I grabbed four or five different commentaries. And in grabbing those four or five different commentaries, I found every one of them said a different thing. And I finally decided, well, let me just sit down and read the book. And what I will do is I'll get some good cross-references and I will take the Bible. I'm going to let it interpret itself. And that's the best way to deal with the book of Revelation. Because guess what? When you do that, you'll find, yeah, you know, the Bible does do that. It tells you exactly what it's going to be talking about. And now when I come to the book of Revelation, folks, I absolutely love this book. Because I can go straight to Scripture and I can show you exactly what God said was going to happen. And I can show you now it did happen. With that in mind, we're going to spend some time doing that. We're going to try to be consistent. One of the other problems that I found with a lot of the earlier interpretations is they would say one thing in regard to a symbol in one place, Let's say, for example, the rider on the white horse that you read about in Revelation chapter 6 doesn't mean exactly the same thing as the rider in white horse that you read about in Revelation chapter 19. It's the same symbol. Oh, it had a minor difference. But they tell you it doesn't mean the same thing. Well, that didn't make sense because God is not the author of confusion. He says he's not. He's rational. He tells us literally that we can understand what he gives us. The term in the book of John, for example, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. Word, Greek, logos, means intelligence, rational. God has always claimed to be rational, and he does not intentionally deceive his children. So with that in mind, I grabbed the book of Revelation, and I began to read it. First thing I understood as I opened the book, Book of Revelation is addressed to the seven churches which are in Asia. Those churches existed in the first century, and God intended for the people in the first century to understand it. Now, guess what I finally realized at that point? If he intended people in the first century to understand it, he's not talking about Muhammad. If he intended people in the first century to understand it, he's probably not talking about Henry Kissinger or George Bush or Barack Obama or any of the other people in modern times. So, with these things behind us, here are some things to remember as we go into the book. It was written to seven real historical churches that existed in the first century. Secondly, there was a blessing that was given to everyone who would study it. Everyone. That included those in the first century. Look at Revelation 1:3. Blessed is the one who reads the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear it and take to heart what is written in it, because the time is near. Now, it is important for you to understand how God introduces this book of Revelation. He says there is a blessing to everyone, no matter the age. We're not talking about the first century only. We're not talking about the 21st century only. Everyone in every age can get a blessing from reading this book and from understanding it. But that means people in the third century had to understand it just like people in the 21st. Another thing that I want you to understand, sometimes when you look at the book of Revelation, you'll see it called the apocalypse. The word apocalypse in Greek is a very interesting word because it means to reveal. Hence, you have revel, reveal, ation. God is revealing things. He's not concealing things. What we've happened to do to this book over the years is turn it into something that God is hiding something. But there is no indication that God is hiding something anywhere. And so everyone, including those in the first century, were to get a blessing from reading it. And that's important. So if that's the case, why does God use this apocalyptic or symbolic writing if his goal is for everybody to understand? As you look at this next slide, let me just tell you that people in the first century were surrounded by all sorts of symbols of power. Symbols of Roman power and the Roman emperors and their greatness were found in the buildings. They were found on coins. They were found on arches of triumph that led into the city. Everywhere you turned, you saw all of these great symbols of power and authority. Apocalyptic literature is writing in symbols in order to help you understand. Please know also that for the most part, people who were living in the first century didn't have access to written copies of the Bible. Not at home anyway. Now they may have had one at the church where they were going, or somebody in the congregation may have had it. They may have had to wait till one of the preachers came wandering through carrying a scroll. But the average person didn't learn from reading. They learn from hearing. And as learning from hearing, you learn from symbols. And so the book of Revelation was designed to help people symbolize the concepts that God was trying to get across. Now, with that in mind, here's the next thing that we need to remember. In the book of Revelation, seven times, he tells us that the events that were to happen in this book are near, seven times. They're at hand, they're soon, they're going to happen in those time periods. Revelation 1:1, he says, these are the things which must shortly come to pass. In verse 3, he says, the time is near. In verse 19, he says, the things which are about to occur. Now, that's three times in the opening chapter. Do you think he's trying to get a message across? Well, if that's the case, then look at the last chapter, because in chapter 22, he says in verse 6, these are things that must shortly take place. And in verse 10, he says to John, don't seal up the prophecy of this book because the time is near. Now, let me take just a moment here and talk to you about the Old Testament book of Daniel. In the Old Testament book of Daniel, Daniel is talking about events that scholars will tell you happened in the first century during the Roman Empire, the coming of Jesus, the Messiah, all of that happened. And they'll tell you it did. Now then, Daniel is writing a little over 500 years before the time of Christ. God gives Daniel these instructions. Seal up the words of your prophecy because the time is far off. You seal it up, it's a long way in the future, and he's talking 500 years. Now, John understands Daniel because he quotes from the book over and over again. And when you come to the book of Revelation, here's God's instruction. Don't seal up the book because the time is near. God is not the author of confusion. He's not going to say one thing in one place and something entirely different in another. God is consistent. He is talking about events that are about to happen. So the next question we need to deal with is, when was the book written and why does it matter anyway? You see two numbers on the screen, and those two numbers are important. Book of Revelation was either written in 69 AD or immediately before that, or it was written in 96 according to the scholars. Now, it's important because the book of Revelation is a book of prophecy. And it is talking about events that are in the future from the day it was written. Nobody questions that. Now, 70 AD was a very crucial year in the history of the Jewish nation and in the history of Christianity because it marked the destruction of Jerusalem and the fall forever of the sacrificial system of the Jews, etc. Now then, if this book is written 69 AD or a little before, then it might be talking about the fall of the city of Jerusalem. I'm not going to say it is right now. It might be. If it was written in 96, it's not talking about the fall of Jerusalem. So it's important that we understand as we begin to look. So with that in mind, it contains prophecy, and so let's try to determine. Does the Bible itself give us any hints as to the date that John is doing the writing? And the answer is, yes, it does. So at this point, you can turn in your Bibles, if you want to Revelation 17, and the verse will actually be on the screen in front of you. As part of the discussion of his symbols, John says, here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads of the beast are, underscore this, they represent seven mountains on which the woman sits. The seven heads are seven mountains. But notice he says it means two things. They also represent seven kings. Five of these kings have fallen. One is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue for a short time. So, what can we understand from that? John says that this symbol of the seven-headed beast represents seven kings and seven hills. And John says he is writing during the days of the sixth king, and the one that's going to come after this king is only going to be around for a short time. So who is this sixth king? With that in mind, what do we know about the seven hills or the seven mountains? Well, all you have to do is look to literature, and ancient writers, whether you're talking Jewish, Christian, pagan, whatever, they universally label Rome as the city that sits on seven hills. So if you were living in the first century when this is written, whether it's 96 or 69, and you hear about something on seven hills, you're going to think Rome automatically. In addition to that, you can find all sorts of these old Roman coins with the goddess Roma on the coin, and it will show the goddess Roma representing the city of Rome sitting on seven hills. So again, it's pretty obvious the symbols were set there. The city of Rome celebrated what was known as the Septimonium, or the Feast of the Seven Hill City. And again, Jewish and Christian writers from the 1st through the 8th century call Rome the city on the seven hills. So it's pretty obvious it's talking about Rome. So who are the seven kings of Rome? Well, again, all you have to do is go to history. Here is the king list from Rome. You start with Julius, number one, and then Augustus or Octavius, and then Tiberius and Caligula, Claudius. Those are your five. The Bible says these are dead. They are fallen. That gets us to number six. One is. That's Nero. Now, he also says the one who follows him is only going to be around for a short time. So who followed Nero? A man by the name of Galba. Galba was only in Rome for 7 months after the death of Nero, and really he only reigned for about three. Now, the average reign of all the Caesars up until that time had been somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 years. Five have fallen, one is, the one who follows will only reign a short time. It's a perfect fit. All right, what else can we learn? In Revelation chapter 11, you find another hint that the Bible gives you about when this book is written. As part of another prophecy, John is told, "There was given me a reed, and the angel said, 'Rise and measure the temple of God, and the altar, and them that worship therein. But the court which is without the temple, leave out and measure it not.'" Notice the reason. "It is given to the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months." So part of the prophecy is Jerusalem and the temple given to the Gentiles. The city will be trodden underfoot by the Gentiles for 42 months. Let the Bible explain what this means. Go to Jesus' concept in Luke 21. In Luke chapter 21, he is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, and I'll show you that later. But it's very obvious. It's very simple. As part of the events associated with the destruction of Jerusalem, he said, "Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles is fulfilled." 42 months was the prophecy. Vespasian, the Roman general, began the siege in February of 67 AD. He ended the siege with the destruction of the temple in August of 70 AD. That's exactly 42 months. Now, what other evidence do we have for the fact that this book was written 69 AD or before? You have references in Revelations chapters 2 and 6 and 10 that all are talking about a persecution of Christians by the Jews. But folks, in 70 AD, when Jerusalem fell, that persecution came to an end because the Jewish nation was completely broken. They didn't have the opportunity to persecute anybody. They didn't have the power to persecute anybody. In addition to that, they sure didn't do it in the Roman Empire because the Romans had just thoroughly annihilated most of the Jews, and anyone who was left was looked on with a great deal of suspicion, and Rome didn't pay any attention to anything they said. And up until then, the Jews had always relied on the Roman cooperation to persecute Christians. But when you're reading the Revelation, the Jews are persecuting Christians. Now, those are very powerful evidences that come from Scripture itself. What about outside the Bible? Actually, there was one and only one writer from early Christian history, a man by the name of Irenaeus, who argued that the book was written during the time of Domitian. That's 96. All of the others said differently. One of those is a very interesting little book called The Shepherd of Hermas. Now, outside the 27 books that you have in your New Testament, you need to understand that this little book was quoted by more early Christian writers than any other book. You probably also need to know that in addition to that, there were a lot of people who respected it so much that they want to actually include it in the Bible itself. Now, before you get too far afield, let me tell you, there's nothing in the Shepherd of Hermas that contradicts anything in the other 27 books of the New Testament. So don't get upset, okay? But now with that in mind, the next thing you begin to notice is this little book, which was written, we know, around 80 AD, quotes extensively from the book of Revelation. And there's no way it could be quoting from the book of Revelation if the book didn't already exist. So it was already in existence at that time. Scholars tell us that this book was written by the same person that's mentioned in Romans chapter 16, verse 14. It would have been the 28th book of the New Testament if a lot of people have had their ways about it. But with that in mind, what evidence do we have? And on this next slide, I'm just going to show you a number of early Christian writers. All of these basically place the writing of the book of Revelation during the time of Nero. Don't need to go through it. That's just for your information. Every major scholar around will tell you that the book of Revelation was written to provide hope and consolation for Christians who were suffering terribly from persecution. Now, how would first century Christians gain hope with, don't worry, help is on the way, it's only about 2,000 years in the future? That wouldn't be a lot of consolation to people living in the first century. But everybody tells you it was written to give them hope and to give them consolation. Okay, with that background in mind, let's continue a little bit further. Let's look at the Old Testament connection. You might need to know that there are 348 quotations from the Old Testament in the 22 chapters of Revelation. That's almost one. Every chapter almost has 15 quotations. That's a lot, folks. 79 from Isaiah, then Daniel, Ezekiel, etc. The book of Revelation, when you get right down to it, is what scholars call a Jewish book. Now, here's what they will tell you. They'll tell you that the book of Matthew was written to Jewish Christians, and they'll tell you that because of the content. Content talks about Old Testament scripture throughout. They'll tell you Mark was written as a generic book, that Luke was written to Gentiles, etc. But they'll tell you Matthew was written to Jews because of all these Jewish references. Then you come to the book of Hebrews. The book of Hebrews is written to Jewish Christians. And how do we know? Well, all of the Jewish references that are in it. Then you come to the letter written by James. And James says he is writing to Jewish Christians. And you find all these Jewish references. Now here's the clincher. The book of Revelation has more Jewish content than any of the other two put together. So it's obviously written with a Jewish connection in mind somehow. There is a Jewish book here. In addition, when you look to Asia Minor, you find that there was a large community of Jews that were living in Asia Minor in the time of the first century. You remember the Apostle Paul came from Asia Minor. He was a Jew. He was raised in Tarsus, Asia Minor. You remember when Paul went on his missionary journeys throughout Asia Minor. He went to the synagogues first. Jewish representatives there in the synagogues. So the Old Testament connection is rather obvious. You want to understand the book of Revelation, you got to understand the Old Testament. Now, in addition, one other thing, in order to understand the book of Revelation, you've also got to understand the New Testament connection, and specifically a number of the parables that Jesus gives in regard to the destruction. You'll notice these on the screen in front of you. Matthew chapter 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21 are all talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Then there's Matthew 19, Matthew 21, Matthew 22, Matthew 23. Remember I told you Matthew is a Jewish gospel? Every one of those chapters contains references where Jesus is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. And it's important that you know that because when you sit down and start studying the book of Revelation, all of a sudden, you're going to find those references popping up again and again. Okay, let's look at some of those descriptions. Let's go to Matthew chapter 20. Matthew chapter 20, first place that we'll look at. Jesus is in his last week on earth, and he has been in Bethany, and he goes from Bethany across the Mount of Olives and into the city. And it says, early in the morning, as Jesus was on his way back to the city, he was hungry. Seeing a fig tree by the road, he went up to it, but found nothing on it except leaves. And he said, may you never bear fruit again. Immediately, the tree withered. When the disciples saw this, they were amazed. How did the fig tree wither so quickly, they asked. Jesus replied, truly I tell you, if you have faith and do not doubt, not only can you do what was done to the fig tree, but also you can say to this mountain. Notice he didn't say, you can say to a mountain. He's talking about a specific one. To this mountain, go throw yourself into the sea and it will be done. And if you believe, you will receive whatever you ask for in prayer. Now, before we go on, let me just tell you that there were symbols that represented ancient Israel. If I ask you what the symbols of modern America are, you can tell me probably a dollar bill. That would be appropriate. But it's also the Statue of Liberty or an eagle or the American flag. There were representative symbols for ancient Israel. There were a vineyard and a fig tree and Mount Zion where the temple was located. If you say to this mountain, when Jesus is giving this illustration, he is standing at Mount Zion. If you say to this mountain, Mount Zion, the temple, Jerusalem, the Jewish concepts, be thrown into the sea, it will be done. Let's continue. Matthew 21. Listen to another parable. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a wine press in it, and built a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and moved to another place. When the harvest time approached, he sent his servants to the tenants to collect its fruit. The tenants seized his servants. They beat one, killed another, and stoned a third. He sent other servants to them, more than the first, and the tenants treated them the same way. Last of all, he sent his son to them, saying, "They will respect my son." But when the tenants saw the son, they said to each other, "This is the heir. Come, let's kill him and take his inheritance." So they took him and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. Therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those tenants? And notice their answer. "He will bring those wretches to a wretched end," they replied, "and he will rent the vineyard to other tenants." Skip down to verse 45. When the chief priests and the Pharisees heard Jesus' parables, they knew he was talking about them. So real quickly, what is the meaning of the text? Landowner, that's God. Vineyard, that's ancient Israel. The hedge, God protecting them. The servants, those are the prophets. The wicked servants, those are the Jewish leaders. The son, that's Jesus. And note what it says, they knew exactly who he was. The leaders of the Jews knew. Let's go to Matthew 22. The kingdom of heaven is like a king who prepared a wedding banquet for his son. He sent his servants to those who had been invited to the banquet to tell them to come, but they refused to come. Then he sent more servants and said, "Tell those who have been invited that I have prepared my dinner. Come to the wedding banquet." They seized his servants, mistreated them, and killed them. The king was enraged. He sent his army and destroyed those murderers and burned their city. He's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Then you come to Matthew chapter 23. Jesus says that the Jewish leaders are descendants of those who killed the prophets, and he says in Matthew 23 to them, "You will," notice this, "fill up the measure of their father's wrath and guilt." And he says, damnation will come on, quote, this generation. Note the ending, Matthew chapter 23, and the opening of Matthew 24. Jesus has just left the temple area. His apostles come to him and say, "Aren't these wonderful buildings? Isn't this a marvelous place?" And it was. And Jesus said, "There won't be one stone left here on top of another that will not be thrown down." And the disciples are absolutely crushed. They're not expecting that. They walk down the Kidron Valley up onto the Mount of Olives, and they get over there, and Jesus then turns around and faces them, and they say, "Please, tell us, when are these things going to happen?" "Well, what things?" "One stone will not be left on another," the destruction of Jerusalem. He is obviously talking about that one event. So, in Matthew chapter 24, Jesus proceeds to give signs. He tells them, he said, "You can recognize when these things are about to happen." We're going to fly through these real quickly. First of all, in Matthew 24, he says there are going to be a lot of false messiahs that are going to show up. That happened. Literally, Josephus, the Jewish writer in that time period, said they were crucifying one person a day. One a day that were claiming to be the Messiah. He said, "You will hear about wars and rumors of wars." That literally happened in the first century. You see, when all of these prophecies are being given by Jesus, they were in what was called the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome. It was a time where Rome had so much power that no one dared openly oppose them. There were no wars. Rome ruled with a rod of iron. But then it wasn't long until they began to slip. And Caligula made the mistake of saying, "I'm going to bring a statue of myself and put it in your temple in Jerusalem." The Jews were so upset that they said, "We'll fight. And not only will we do that, we'll show you." They didn't plant their crops. They didn't send their children to school. Caligula died, but there was the rumor of war. Wars and rumors of wars. Famines, earthquakes, plagues, all of those happened in the first century. All you have to do is go back and look at the history books. Then he says there will be signs in the heavens. Those also events that occurred in the first century. Don't have time to go into detail. He said the church would be persecuted. It happened. All you have to do is read your Bible, read your New Testament. Many false prophets will appear. Read the New Testament over and over again. They're warning about false prophets. So again, Jesus is using that to tell them these things are about to take place. Now, he also says, as a result of that, the abomination of desolation described by Daniel will be a sign to my followers that it's time for you to get out of Jerusalem. He's quoting from Daniel chapter 9. So let's look at the reading here. In Daniel 9, here's that prophecy. The people, that is the Romans, of the prince who will come. Vespasian started the war against Jerusalem. But in the middle of it, Nero dies, and there's civil war in Rome, and Vespasian is called back to become the next Caesar. And he leaves his son, the prince, Titus, to finish up the job in Jerusalem. People, Romans, of the prince to come, Titus, will destroy the city, and they did in 70 AD, and the sanctuary, the temple, and they did. Now, if you want to know exactly what this means, Luke chapter 21 is talking about the same thing. And Luke says, when you see armies surrounding the city, know it's time to get out. So the Christians were given signs. They were told to flee when they saw this. It's not the end of the world. How do you know that? Because Jesus says it's not. He says, when this happens, pray that your flight not be in the wintertime. End of the world doesn't matter whether it's summer, winter, spring, or fall. He says, pray it not be on the Sabbath day. End of the world, it doesn't matter whether it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, etc. He says, pray that if you're a young mother, that you not be nursing during that. It's not going to matter at the end of the world. But it did matter in 70 AD when it was a physical event that was taking place. But now, the main thing is, Jesus has given all of these very specific instructions to his people. And he says, when you see these things, then you know that the destruction of Jerusalem is near. Get out. So, what happens? It's interesting to see that in the year 67 AD, following events take place. How much time do I have left? Okay, all right. Dexter said I didn't have to worry about that, so I'll just... No, I'm just kidding. All right, 67 A.D. The Jews didn't have a CIA or a KGB or a good intelligence or spy satellites, and so when they launched their revolt against Rome in the fall of 66 A.D., they didn't realize that sitting on their borders were Rome's most powerful legions. They were just coming back from war with the Parthians, and they were in the city of Damascus. And when word came that the city of Jerusalem was in rebellion against Rome, Cestius Gallus, the commander of those powerful legions, literally marched those Roman legions into Galilee immediately. We'll talk about that in more detail later. It didn't take him long to overcome the opposition. And by 67 AD, he has the Roman legions surrounding the city of Jerusalem. Surrounding the city. They began to hammer away with their war engines at the walls of the city. And Josephus is an eyewitness. He's a Jewish writer. He was the actual captain of the Jewish army in Galilee that got beat. That's another story. But anyway, he is actually watching all this taking place. And he says the city of Jerusalem is one day away from falling. That everybody inside the city has just given up, and they're ready to surrender. Josephus is with the Romans, and he literally says this in his book, for no known reason, Gallus orders a retreat of the Roman legions. And the Roman legions pull back from the city of Jerusalem. Here's what Jesus had said. When you see those armies surround the city, when the abomination spoken of by Daniel is standing where it ought not, then you get out of the city. And he says this, if you're on the housetop, you don't go back down into the house to get anything. If you're out in the field, you don't dare go back into the city, because then is the time of the end. He's talking about the end of Jerusalem. 67 AD, as Gallus is pulling his troops back, the Jews pour out of the city and start chasing the Romans. At that point, every Christian inside the city of Jerusalem left the city of Jerusalem. They went across the Jordan River to the city of Pella, and they stayed there throughout the remainder of the Roman-Jewish war. They stayed there. That's another point that you'll see a little bit later, too, in the book of Revelation. Now, when you come to the book of Revelation, you find all sorts of signs. Signs about things that are to take place in the end. A lot of signs. Let me see. If I go back to the book of Matthew, I remember Jesus saying, in regard to the end of the world, of that day and hour knoweth no man. Not the Father. I mean, only the Father, not even the Son. There are not going to be any signs. And he says that. He says it'll be just like it was in the day of Noah. People will be just going on with their regular lives, with their business as usual. And the end's going to come like that for the end of the world. But he gave sign after sign after sign for the fall of Jerusalem. You come to the book of Revelation and you have sign after sign after sign about the fall of some city. God is not the author of confusion. He is not going to give us mixed signals. Now, when we come to the book of Revelation, and let me do this real... Do I have time to finish? Okay, real quickly, let's go to Revelation chapter 1. This won't take but a minute. John, to the seven churches which are in Asia, grace and peace from him who is and who was and who is to come, from the seven spirits who are before his throne, and from Jesus Christ, the faithful witness, the firstborn from the dead, the ruler over the kings of earth, to him who loved us and washed us from our sins in his own blood, and has made us kings. Please notice, they are already in the kingdom. Kingdom is not something out in the future, it's there in the first century. Has made us kings and priests to his God and Father, to him be glory and dominion forever and ever. Behold, he is coming with clouds. Every eye will see him, even they who pierced him. All the tribes of the earth will mourn because of him. There's an interesting passage in Daniel chapter 7 which talks about the beginning of the kingdom. And in Daniel 7:13 it says, I saw in the night visions, behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds. Okay? Coming of clouds. What's he talking about? Let him explain. Look, Matthew chapter 24. Jesus, talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, said specifically, then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn. Back to Revelation 1, all the tribes of the earth will mourn. Same exact statement. And they shall see the Son of Man, who's going to see him? The Jewish leaders who have ordered his execution. They shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Jesus is saying very specifically, I am coming in some way in judgment on the Jewish nation in the first century. He makes that very specific claim. Now, a little bit later, in Matthew chapter 24, he says pretty much exactly the same concept. Mark chapter 13, he says the same thing. And if you'll go to the last slide, I believe it is, or next to the last, Matthew 26:64. Jesus said to him, nevertheless, I say unto you, he's talking to Caiaphas, you, Caiaphas, will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven. The theme of the book of Revelation is the destruction of Jerusalem and the consummation of God's kingdom on earth, his people, so that it would never fail. And we'll talk about then the book of Revelation in a lot more detail. Go to the last slide. Here's what we're going to be trying to do. Next session, we're going to talk about the seven churches and the opening of the seven seals and the four horsemen, the sounding of the seven trumpets. And then in week 3, we're going to talk about the woman and the dragon. Lord willing, the fourth session, 666, the beast from the sea and the land and the seven bowls, the 1,000 years. And in the last session, the last 2 chapters. Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
I know it's a lot of information in 45 minutes. I will say this, Lord willing, we've got it recorded, don't we, Blake? Are we good on that? All right, we should have it recorded. And I'll try and work with Don, and we might even try and get it on the website for those who have internet. And then if you need a copy, if you want to go back and review some of these things, he's laid a lot of groundwork that's very important to the book of Revelation tonight. We'll do that. And we've also got a copy of the PowerPoint notes. So if there was some note that you missed, we can get that to you. But thank you for being here, and we'll look forward to next week studying again. Thank you. You're dismissed.
I got it.
I sure do, along with a number of others.
It's pretty well right in line with you.
Yes, sir, he is.
I was impressed. I'm legally blind. Library of Congress, talking books.
Thank you.
Talking books, sir. You just send me things. And I've got a copy of it. And I was going to ask Chris, listen to it.
Can you order anything you want?